Nous allons donner tout de suite la parole au professeur Wicksteed, qui est donc John Timothy Wicksteed, qui est professeur émérite de l'Université d'Arizona, qui est connu, qui est bien connu de ceux qui s'intéressent au Kambun japonais par non seulement ses recherches, mais aussi ses essais sur le phénomène du Kambun. C'est un spécialiste évidemment de la poésie chinoise, de style chinois, à la fois chinoise et japonaise. Et je voudrais simplement vous signaler sa dernière publication, qui est de 2018, dans les Sino-Platonic Papers, l'une des collections sinologiques les plus intéressantes qui soit, où il a fait « Literary Sintic and Latin as Transregional Languages with Implications for Terminology Regarding Kambun », ce qui pourra déjà en soi faire l'objet d'une partie de nos discussions de la fin d'après-midi, voire de demain. Mais pour l'instant, il va nous présenter une communication sur « Kanshi and Allusion, Social Intercourse and East Asian Creature ». The example of Morio Gai. Professor Wicksteed, if you...
Thank you very much, Professor Robert. It's an honor to be here. I wanted to talk today about some of my work with in terms of three themes or problems, problematics, as it were, dealing with kanji. And my own experience with dealing with Mori Ogai's kanji, I hope that it can be of interest to you and perhaps resonate with some of your own work. First, there's that of allusion. Post-Tang poetry, I think the biggest problem is allusion. How to explicate it, how to present it when discussing it in any foreign language. This, of course, dovetails with translation and interpretation. And I've first wrestled with this problem writing on a 13th century Chinese poet, where his poems on poetry are so compressed. How do you deal with them? So I presented the text in Chinese, the text in romanization, a barbarized translation, a naturalized translation, and then an essay, 5 to 10 page essay, explaining it in terms of what's he really saying, what earlier criticism is he drawing on, and third, what earlier language is he drawing on to make his write his poem. And so in dealing with kanji or anything in Japanese, Vietnamese, Korean, until recent centuries, this is true. The intertext is inevitably there. They're using the same Chinese vocabulary, at least in some sense. So with kanji, I thought I would like to see the kanji text, the kundoku rendering of how they could be read aloud in Japanese, some sense of the caesure and rhymes. And you either do that with a dialect of Chinese or with ondoku readings. Then naturalized and barbarized readings were necessary, translations were necessary to bring out the literal and paraphrasable sense of lines, and then any text to clarify as necessary. Well, here's just an excerpt, a half of a poem in two translations. One is by Richard Bowring, quite a good paraphrasable sense of the poem. He did it minus the poem title. And then I have it here in the format that I like, with the original text, with barbarized translation, which is really phrase by phrase, not character by character. No, it's phrase by phrase. This is English kundoku, really. Then we have a kundoku rendering, romanized, and in this case, modern Mandarin one. And so we have a barbarized translation, then down below, the a more naturalized one, the milk teeth one, shed, so, blah, blah, blah. I do want to draw your attention to line 3 of the poem, where the barbarized translation says, 3 years beyond the sea, pastime Chung Snow style or time or something, and the more naturalized rendering, for 3 years abroad, I respectfully sought instruction, the snow mounting, the snow time, as happened to the disciples of Chang Yi in the 11th century. Let's go to the second page of my handout, because then I said I wanted those first four things, but where desirable, also notes to clarify terms or allusions. And just the title itself is a very arresting compound in Chinese or Japanese, right? There I cite an earlier use. I'm not saying that Ogai was consciously alluding to Yuxin here, but he clearly knew the compound, and it's not that common a compound. The important thing here is in line three about the Chung Snow. Even translating the passage from the Song dynastic history, you're still left, what in the world does it mean? So I think that the crucial thing with allusions is explaining their use in context. Just pointing them out or giving a literal translation of them, to me, is just an important first step. In other words, what functions does it serve? Is it used to find support and prestige for your current stance, to display one's learning, to test the knowledge of the reader or listener, to be ironic or witty, to ratify or celebrate class membership, or to add a new twist to a familiar turn of phrase, or more precisely, what combination of those things is operative? So I have in darkened lines my interpretation. Otherwise, you still wonder just what the hell does this mean here? And here I have it, the anecdote underscores the patient and respectful attitude one should have when seeking instruction, how much one should value learning, and how quickly time passes in their pursuit. This was Mori Ogai writing just before he retired, reflecting back on his youthful years. So here we have the poem explicated in terms of what I call the triad, diachronicity, the explanation of the title. That's a diachronic explanation. Intertextually, you can't not have diachronic implications. Referentially, in terms of what it means in terms of the Sungshi quotation, and then the real implication of the expressions used. Give some interpretation and some way to try to communicate what I call the five R's there, the rhythm, rhyme, readings, oral, and renderings. And referencing, the referencing of the thing. So then here's another example, a couplet. It's from Mori Ogai, reprint of his book that he edited of experimental writings and translations from 25 years earlier. And so here you find, of course, the original, the Kundoku, the Chinese, and here's the Ondoku readings. Ondoku is fine. Why? Because with a seven-character line, the rhythm is boom, 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 boom. That's boom, 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 boom. That's there. And unless that is communicated somehow, and in terms of for students reading this, for ourselves reading this, if we're a Japanese 19th century or earlier writing this, we're writing it in two in character and three character phrases and single verbal adjectives and verbs. We're doing it in terms of that formulation. So we have a literal rendering with this heavenly pond, moistening desiccated foam, useless to sprinkle water on non-arable fields. Well, what does that mean? what he's saying here is that with freshets of water as from the Milky Way stream, namely my new and experimental writings of 25 years ago that are being reprinted here, both original works and translations, I wanted to resuscitate a literature that was gasping for life, like the frothing fish in Zhuangzi. That's the moistening desiccated foam illusion. But it's pointless to try to water totally barren land. In other words, a public and a literary world, Bundan, both unreceptive. Which it isn't that either translation is right. I think we need both. A paraphrasable, we miss the compression of it. A good paraphrasable one, we often lose the concreteness. Somehow putting them, supplying this combination is the solution that I have come upon for my own work. Let's go on with the problem of illusion. In an article on that, I summarize the very useful work on illusion in Chinese poetry by James Robert Hightower, David Lattimore, and Earl Miner. But I expand it to this business of what function does the illusion serve? And so I went through that. And in treating Ogai, I thought, how do we go about this? And I, taking his entire corpus, he names 16 poets or works in his writing, often with the poetic name or something. There are passages in his Kanchi that are incomprehensible without understanding the allusion. So the texts or authors unquestionably alluded to 21, including these examples here. And there are other works by him that in all likelihood he is alluding to these. And of course, he alludes to them more than once. As a fourth thing thrown in here, I included earlier Japanese kanji writers with phrasing similar to that of Ogai as cited by his commentators. I don't go into that, to what extent he may really be acquainted with or echoing them, but we come up with 12 there. As far as diction is concerned, though, that's fascinating with Ogai, who had an enormous word hoard in a way like Shakespeare. He's one who was, I find three stages. He's the young show-off, the mature grandmaster, and the kind of retired emperor in his last years. But as the show-off, he uses a lot of recondite, recherché expressions. He uses unusual individual kanji, unusual kanji compounds, unusual kanji variants, and ordinary kanji in unusual senses. By the middle years, he has a beautiful balance to this. And in the last years, he puts in the occasional right phrase. It's interesting, right, in those terms. For that matter, I think that his training in Kanbun, in Kanchi, is what made possible his extraordinary talent in rendering this version of Anderson's novel, The Impromptu Poet, the Sokkyo Shijin. I think this is his most creative work, period, with Ogai. It's not a translation, it's Honan, it's an adaptation. And standing in interesting contrast with it is his Faust translation, which is basically in the modern Chinese. It's hard to believe it's by the same person. But it's in the Sokkyo Shijin. If we have in Japan, Robinson Crusoe and Aesop's fables, through translation, becoming part of the Japanese imaginary, part of the Japanese mental landscape, their cultural horizons. That's what Ogai did for Italy. I mean, he created an Italy in this Sokkyo Shijin. It's enchanting. And it served for a century. 20th century writers read this, but it's not now. And with Faust, just by the way, passing, Faust is more important in 20th century Japanese literature than he is in 20th century American literature because of Ogai. He gave the cultural cachet, the endorsement, the stamp of approval that made it part of the intelligent, cultured readership. Let's go on to the second theme, the social role of kanji. As was referred to this morning by Professor Campbell, we have all kinds of social intercourse. And in Ogai's case, he has poems to friends in lieu of letters. Kanji presented to friends. He's joking with friends, outings with friends, consoling friends or giving them advice, mourning friends. And several others are to his sensei and a few to his family. But one major category of social interaction is this business of matching rhyme kanji. But before I hit the matching rhyme kanji, let me point out the dedicatory poems. He wrote many, and certain for other published works. And let me point out something that he did one for Omura Seigai's landmark work on Buddhist sculpture. And what is important, even more than the poem, I think, is the social function of this kanji. Because in effect, in this poem, he's saying, it's written, dedicated to Omura, goes in the front of his translation, and people read it. People who can read it, cultured people can read it. So he's saying, we're enacting civilization. He, by writing such a fine work, others of us, by reading it and gaining further appreciation of our East Asian cultural world, myself, by penning this dedicatory poem in good Sino-Japanese or Sinitic, whatever you want it, and all of you by reading it and appreciating it. Ritually, this is ritual work. It's ritually we are participating in the cultural world of East Asia that these poetic lines developed from and form part of. Like the Chinese art in the volume and the Buddhism that much of it portrays, our kanji world transcends mere borders. So that's a positive way. We go on to the F here on the list. Matching rhyme kanji are ones that are a subcategory of social interaction type ones. They're ones where somebody writes Chinese poem from China or a kanji one in Japan, and you write a poem using the exact same rhyme words in the same order. Okay, and one of them was in his debate with Imai Takeo on the proper term for statistics. And this is where getting into long arguments about nonsense is one part of it, or what degenerates into kind of nonsense. And kanji interchanges satire and ridicule. There's a lot of fun in those poems. But we go on to the next one, G. Some of them get pretty prickly, pretty pointed in their reference to others. We have an anonymous kanji that appeared 7 years after the publication of the Shintaishi Show, in which the author criticized the translations. They weren't by Ogai, but they had appeared published 7 years earlier, and he criticizes them in effect, saying, "Well, originals, the last line of the poem, originals are like jade, translations are mud." Well, what he's saying, translations are crap, translations are dreck. And this old guy takes offense, partly because his own book of edited volume of translations, including his own, Omokage, is coming out in 2 months. And he writes back, are poetic factions any different, East or West? Someday the earlier one had talked about these, the translator should gnaw at his navel, which means it comes from the Zhaojuan and Yangxiong, and it refers to they should gnaw their navel in regret. Well, so what is the old guy says, someday the SOB who wrote that will gnaw his navel. The only shame is blah, blah, blah. So let's go on to the next page, the last page here. What the only shame is, as explicated here for the line 4, the entire line comes from a poem, the Tang author, Tang period author, Sun Shun. And what Ogai is saying, by saying delicate grasses and fresh blossoms trampled are turned to mud, I think we can implicitly understand that, but I bring it out here saying, Olga is saying that the anonymous critic with his poem about Shin Taishi Sho has sullied something that is beautiful. Just as a footnote before we go on to the next topic, I think that translations of poetry that are just, give you the translated text, whether it's naturalized, barbarized, or a beautiful balance between the two, they're usually just skating on the surface if they're interesting poems. And unless we go beyond it, I mean, there are different ways to do it through footnoting, through pages of explanation. But otherwise, I think, what in the world? I mean, this is, let's get serious. So my own reflections on in the Ogai context of how in the world how did Kanchi fit into the East Asian context? Earlier, 20 years ago, I wrote an article talking about the importance of Kanbun. And I'll say, many of you know may know in English, there's a country and Western song, famous one, that said, I was country when country wasn't cool, meaning I like country Western music before it became popular. I was for Kanchi and Kanbun before it came pop. It has picked up an interest in the last 20 years in the Western world. And in Japan, too, for that matter. And anyway, I talked about the importance of Kanbun. It's the most neglected field in Japanese literature, certainly then, and continues that way. Not all the other areas that you could say have been neglected, which is also true, but in degree of importance, degree of range, Kanbun has it hands down. And at the time, I suggested just the contrast, using Chinese for things written by Chinese and Sino-Japanese, etc., for ones by Sino-Korean, by people writing in some form of Chinese in Japan or Korea or whatever. It has the advantage of locating the meta language and giving some identifying marker to it. More recently, Sinitic has become common. I'm quite happy with Sinitic. I'll mention a couple of options I don't prefer in a minute. So in any case, went through Ogai's, a few things stick out reading Ogai, say, compared with Soseki. There's some things that there's a mix of registers. And so I had noted these. And then as against his 250 kanji, I read the, you want a limited number from China. So a good combination is the complete, is the 300 Tang poems and the poems by 1,000 authors who add up to 500, 500. The numbers are misleading. So, in terms of the diction used, I mean, this is Tang, maybe one-third, one-quarter of the Qianjia Shi is from Song times, but at least this is good classical Japanese as a standard. And I found that, yes, a lot of these sort of colloquial phrases do appear in classical Chinese poetry, and I list them all and all that. But they appear statistically twice as often in Ogai's poems, because here we have numbers we can compare. And I could also, you can online go through the 50,000 Tang poems, just plug it in and see if they, that is a base thing. So in Ogai, there is an amalgam of expression that has been integrated that is less common in, uncommon to, or not found in classical Chinese. And classical Chinese itself is a construct, right? So anyway, certain of Ogai's expressions, many of his puns, are scarcely comprehensible without a knowledge of Japanese. And several turns of phrases by him differ significantly from Chinese usage. And one grammatical usage appears that much more often in his work than it does in classical Chinese, that it's what linguistics people call expansion. In other words, it's used in the original language, but it gets used a lot more in the target language. And it's been pointed out in the use of some of the Buddhist translations. Most recently, I've looked at how does this business of Latin and Sinitic fit in, compare, and the sort of, to my mind, simplistic contrast that's been made is Latin is a spoken language. It's the language of communication in Europe through the medieval ages and into the so-called Republic of Letters. And Chinese is not spoken, classical Chinese. Well, I don't buy that. I mean, if you read much of medieval and later Latin was not spoken as much as and as effectively as generally thought. And I draw for this on Julie Barrow, G.G. Colton, Thomas High, and Francoise Wauquiez. And Sinitic is a lot more important for, I mean, I'm talking about the classical language, for spoken purposes, not just diplomatic exchanges. It is a true hieroglyph. It's for Buddhist terms. I feel quite at home with this because I grew up knowing the Latin Mass in Latin years before studying Latin. And so I know what a hieroglyph is, I mean, intrinsically. And and not only that, but we have all this business of literary Sinitic, that's a problem. So how do these kanji fit in with the rest of East Asia? In Ogai's case, yes, we have, as with much late Meiji literature, you know, this proliferation of journals dedicated to kanji writing. We have circles, coteries, we have all of this exchange, we have all the social interaction that's referred to. So, and on a national level, yes, with the publications, the proliferation of publications late 19th century, that it is national. Interesting in Ogai's case, even though he did matching rhyme poems with one Chinese and dedicated a couple of poems to visiting Chinese students, he never had illusions of Chinese in China reading his kanji. I think in that he may be different from certain other Japanese writers in other times. I'm just talking about it from my point of view. But anyway, I've mentioned that I'd prefer either the Japano-Sinitic, Sino-Japanese, Sinitic, for what it's worth, classical Chinese, a lot of the writing does not use classical language, classical, in some case, even diction structures, or literary Sinitic. It may not be literary. It may have the same problems of vocabulary. God, literary Chinese, and God knows, is it Chinese? some people who've read a lot more Chinese than I have, like Wilt Edema, swears this stuff is not Chinese, his reaction to the things that Ivo Smits has dealt with. And that's in some ways a lot closer to the classical than the modern thing. As a half tongue-in-cheek, I thought, well, what can we call it? On the one hand, Sinitic is good because it stresses the higher gloss. I hate Sinosphere, by the way, because that makes Japan, Korea, Vietnam subordinate, and it plays to Chinese chauvinism. Sinosphere, yes, that we all know they're inferior versions of us. No. So how do we get around that? Sinitic does create a certain distance. But half jokingly, I wrote this EA Criture, which would emphasize the written nature. So I just consider it. I have ambivalent feelings myself. But it emphasizes the written nature of the shared language. It's pan-East Asian. It's geographically neutral. It allows for a good degree of portability, as long as there's some measure of comprehensibility. After this morning's talks about in Vietnam and in Zhuang stuff, I feel humbled. I mean, who's going to read these damn, who can read these languages, these in Sinitic script? And it sidesteps that problem of literary value. So that's what I throw out for today.